Chapter 10. The Sweetest Kiss. She moved on from Newcastle after a week, her judgments made. In the case that she had described to Charlie at dinner, she gave the children to the grandparents and allowed weekly visits from the mother and father separately. In the late afternoon of Friday, she said goodbye to her colleagues at the court. On Saturday morning, Pauling drove them west to the city of Carlisle. As they slowed in heavy traffic, Fiona's phone lay in her hand, and she was thinking, as she had done often through the week, of the kiss. How stupid of her not to have stopped it. It was professional and social madness. She tried to act like it was just something quick and innocent, but each time it grew in her mind until she no longer knew what it was or what had happened. Caradoc Ball could have stepped into the hall at any moment, or one of his guests might have seen her. Pauling could have turned back from his conversation with the driver and surprised her. Then the formal, polite distance between them which made her work possible would have been destroyed. She did not usually do wild things, and she did not understand why she had behaved like that. She realised that there was more to her feelings than just professional worries, but at the moment this was what filled her mind. It was hard to believe that no one had seen them, that she had escaped without anyone knowing about her crime. Maybe someone had seen her, and miles away in London they were discussing it now. She imagined the voice on the phone of an embarrassed colleague. "Ah, Fiona, look, I'm sorry, but I should warn you that something's happened." She decided to call her husband, knowing that she was running from a kiss to the safety of her marriage. She made the call from habit, without thinking about how things were between her and Jack. When she heard his careful "hello" echo slightly, she knew he was in the kitchen. She could hear the radio playing. He asked her if she was all right, and she replied, "Fine." It surprised her how normal she sounded. She reminded him of her return date at the end of the month and suggested that on the evening she came home, they should go out for a meal together. They usually did this when she returned from circuit. He said in a surprised voice that he thought it was a good idea. He asked her again if she was all right, and she repeated that she was fine. It had worked. She was lifted from her worries into the firmness of an arrangement, a date. It was good to have phoned and moved things on from that strange breakfast moment. The world was not how she had worriedly dreamed it. An hour later, they were driving into Carlisle, and she was concentrating on court papers. And so, 2 weeks later, her circuit complete, she faced her husband in a quiet corner of a restaurant near their apartment. A bottle of wine stood between them, which they were drinking slowly. They did not talk about their relationship, the subject which might have destroyed them. He spoke to her awkwardly, like she was some kind of bomb which might explode. She asked him about his work. Later, when they had covered the safe subjects, there came a worrying silence. She kept thinking about what he had done, leaving her to be with Melanie, and she knew that he felt she was making too much of it. The end of the war between them was not quick. They began to eat meals together again, to go to supper together with friends, but he still slept in the spare room, and when a 19-year-old nephew came to stay, he slept on the sofa. Late October came. The clocks went back and the darkness closed in. Not much changed between her and Jack, but she was too busy and too tired to start the big conversations that might move them to a new stage. In the evenings, if she had the energy, she practiced alone at the piano to prepare for a Christmas concert with Mark Burner at the Royal Courts of Justice's Great Hall. Jack was busy too, doing the work of a sick colleague at the university. At the end of October, as Fiona looked through her morning post at the courts, she found another blue envelope. Pauling was in the room at the time. When he had left, she opened it. Adam had sent her an unfinished poem. There was no letter with it. The Song of Adam Henry. I took my wooden cross and laid it by the stream. I was young and foolish and worried by a dream that punishment was stupid, the type of thing for fools, but I'd been told on Sundays to live life by the rules. The cross cut into my shoulder. It was heavy as lead. My life was narrow and godly, and I was almost dead. The stream was happy and dancing, and sunlight danced around, but I must keep on walking, with eyes fixed to the ground. Then a fish jumped out of the water, with rainbows on its scales. The water danced around it and hung in silver tails. Throw your cross into the water if you're wanting to be free. So I drowned my cross in the water, in the shade of the Judas tree. I kneeled by the river and felt full of bliss, while she leaned on my shoulder and gave the sweetest kiss. Then she jumped into its icy bottom, where she'll never more be found. And I was full of tears until I heard the music sound. And God stood on the water, and he said this to me: that fish was the voice of Satan, and you must pay the fine. Her kiss was the kiss of Judas. Her kiss sold my name. May he what? The last words were lost to lines of pen which went around and around. Words taken out, put back, taken out. She read the poem again, then sat back with her eyes closed. She didn't like it that he was angry with her, thinking she was Satan. In her head, she started writing a letter to him that she knew she would never send. I had to send you away. It was in your own interests. You have your own young life to lead. Even if we had the room, you could not live with us. This is simply not possible for a judge. Adam, I'm not Judas. An old lady, perhaps. Her sweetest kiss had been crazy, and she had not escaped her crime, not in his eyes. It was kinder not to reply to him. He would write straight back to her if she did. He would be at her door, and she'd have to make him go away again. She put the poem back in the envelope, and later put it in her bedside table. He would soon move on and do brilliantly in his exams, then go to a good university. He would forget her.